Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated, open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Right, so to give you the bottom line up front for today's briefing, we are seeing a rapid global shift where major militaries and sanctioned states are blending highly advanced cyber and naval strategies with incredibly low-tech physical adaptations just to survive. This dynamic is drastically reshaping operational realities from the Korean Peninsula and the Black Sea all the way to the Caribbean. And ultimately, these asymmetric supply chains are dictating the future of global power projection.
Yeah, and that tension between high-tech ambition and low-tech reality, that is exactly the through line for our deep dive today. We've got a really fascinating stack of reporting to unpack for you.
We really do.
Just to be clear up front, though, we are looking at some heavily debated geopolitical intelligence. So we aren't taking sides or endorsing the specific viewpoints in these reports. Our mission is purely analytical. We're just here to impartially break down the facts and the data provided by these sources so you can understand the mechanisms driving these shifts.
Exactly. We are pulling from a pretty wide array of open source intelligence today. We've got military analysis from the war zone, covering Chinese naval developments, and some interesting South Korean defensive exercises. We're also looking at intelligence updates from the Institute for the Study of War, or ISW, detailing the tactical situations with Russia, Ukraine, and Iran.
Right.
Plus, we'll examine a pretty stark economic brief from the Council on Foreign Relations regarding Cuba, and a report from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, on Russian and Iranian cyber coordination.
So, whether you're trying to stay ahead of the curve for your next strategy meeting, or you just want to understand why global supply chains are so incredibly fragile right now, this deep dive is going to connect those dots. Let's start on the tactical level.
Yeah, the physical battlefield.
Right, because if you want to protect a multi-billion dollar military operation today, you know, you'd think you need lasers or an electromagnetic shield. But based on the report from the war zone, what you actually might need is basically heavy-duty batting cage netting.
It sounds absurd, but it's true.
I was looking at their report on this recent U.S. and South Korean military exercise. It's called CJ Lots 26, taking place at Daegu Beach in South Korea.
And just for context for you listening, CJ Lot stands for Combined Joint Logistics Over the Shore. So this is not a small drill.
No, not at all.
It's this massive operation where militaries practice moving heavy cargo and vehicles from big transport ships out in deep water directly onto a beach, you know, where there's no traditional port facility.
Right. And to do that, they use these massive floating platforms. The war zone calls them improved Navy lighterage systems, basically these big motorized steel docks. But the photos from the exercise show these advanced platforms draped in just nylon mesh netting over the cargo and personnel.
Yeah.
So I have to ask, okay, let's unpack this. We have billion-dollar militaries deploying what essentially look like fishing nets. Is this really the best defense we have against drones?
Well, it looks primitive, I know, but it is a necessary layer of defense.
Yeah.
Especially against the threat that Ukraine has completely mastered right now.
Right.
If we pull in that intelligence from the ISW regarding the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Ukraine's unmanned systems forces are actively paralyzing Russian fuel shipping in the Azov and Black Sea.
Oh, wow. I thought the focus was mostly on sinking, you know, massive Russian warships. Why pivot to small tankers and tugboats?
Because logistics win wars, right? Ukraine has made Russia's ground supply lines so dangerous that they're forcing Russia to rely on maritime routes to move fuel. And the ISW notes that Russia is now so terrified of the Kerch Strait Bridge being targeted again that they're just avoiding using it for crucial logistics.
Okay, but why not just shoot the drones down?
Well, Russia simply doesn't have enough $2 million air defense missiles to escort every single tugboat and fuel barge. I mean, the math of defending against a $1,000 drone with a multi-million dollar missile, it just doesn't work.
Which brings us back to the netting, right? But I want to talk about the mechanics here. A drone flying at 100 miles an hour, strapped with explosives, how does a simple nylon net actually stop that? Doesn't the explosion just blast right through?
That is where the physics of the weapon become really important. Because these FPV drones, first-person view drones, are typically armed with shaped charges. It's similar to an anti-tank grenade. And a shaped charge doesn't just make a big fireball. It uses explosives to instantly melt a cone of copper into this hypervelocity jet of molten metal. And that jet punches right through thick steel armor.
That's terrifying.
It is. But for that copper jet to form properly, the explosive has to detonate at an exact, very specific distance from the armor.
Ah, okay. So the net isn't meant to absorb the blast. It's meant to ruin the timing of the detonation.
Exactly. When the drone hits the mesh net, one of two things happens. Either the rotors just get tangled in the nylon and it crashes into the water, or the net triggers the explosive too early.
Right, so it detonates too far away.
Precisely. If it detonates even a few feet away from the actual hull of the ship, that armor-piercing copper jet just disperses harmlessly into the air. It completely neutralizes the physics of the weapon.
That makes perfect sense. It's like throwing a wrench into a highly calibrated engine. But the fact that this low-tech defense is necessary everywhere from South Korea to the Black Sea, it just shows how universal this asymmetric threat has become.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the technology driving these cheap drones isn't staying isolated. We're seeing sanctioned nations actively sharing this tech to bypass Western defenses.
Right. The transition from tactical innovation to global proliferation is happening incredibly fast,
right,
particularly between Russia and Iran.
Yeah. The ISW update on Iran highlights exactly this. Syrian authorities intercepted the smuggling operation orchestrated by the IRGC, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Right.
They were hiding weapons inside commercial oil tanker trucks crossing from Iraq into Syria, destined for Hezbollah in Lebanon. And when they searched the trucks, they found hundreds of these FPV drones. But they weren't standard radio control drones. They were fiber optic drones.
Which is fascinating.
Built with Chinese-made fiber optic spools and Russian origin drone hardware.
The inclusion of that fiber optic wire is a brilliant, albeit really alarming, adaptation. Mm-hmm. Because traditionally, the primary way a modern military defeats an incoming drone, if they don't have netting, is electronic warfare.
Jamming the signal.
Right. You blast the area with radio frequency interference to sever the wireless connection between the drone and the pilot.
But if the drone is physically tethered by a wire,
you can't jam a physical cable.
Wow.
Exactly. The drone spools out a literal physical thread of glass behind it as it flies, so it's entirely immune to traditional electronic jamming. The pilot gets a crystal clear video feed and sends control inputs right through the wire.
That's incredible. And the fact that the IRGC is smuggling these to Hezbollah using a supply chain that mixes Chinese spools with Russian drone hardware, it just demonstrates how effectively these states have integrated their physical supply networks.
Yeah, definitely have in the physical realm. But, you know, when we look at their digital collaboration, I think we need to carefully examine the narrative.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's easy to look at Russia and Iran sharing drone parts and just assume they also have this impenetrable, deeply integrated alliance in cyberspace. But the report from CSIS paints a much more complicated reality.
What's fascinating here is that it highlights a fundamental limitation of alliances built between autocracies. The CSIS report confirms there is communication in the cyber realm. We do see Russian hacktivist groups like the Z-Pentest Alliance and Nona Mezzo 57 openly chatting on Telegram with Iran's Handala hack.
Right. Coordinating low-level operations, like mutually agreeing to publish targeting data on Israeli energy facilities.
Exactly. But the report explicitly warns against viewing this as state-to-state military integration.
So why is there a ceiling on their cyber collaboration? If they share the same geopolitical adversaries, wouldn't they want to work together?
Because of profound, historically justified paranoia. To understand why Russia and Iran don't share their top-tier cyber weapons, you have to look at the Turla incident from a few years ago, which the CSIS report references. Turla is this highly sophisticated, state-sponsored Russian cyber espionage group. And what they did to Iran was basically a masterpiece of digital betrayal.
I read this part of the report, and the mechanics are just wild. Walk us through how a digital false flag operation actually works in this context.
Well, normally in a false flag operation, you leave behind fake evidence to frame someone else, right? But Turla went much further. They actually hacked into the Iranian command and control servers first.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They compromised the very infrastructure Iran uses to conduct its own cyber operations. Then, the Russians used the Iranian servers to launch attacks against dozens of other countries.
So it wasn't just planting a fake Iranian flag at the scene of the crime. It's more like, I don't know, breaking into someone's house, logging onto their personal laptop, and using it to launch a cyber attack.
That is the perfect analogy.
And then when the authorities traced the IP address, they kicked down the homeowner's door, completely unaware the Russian hackers were the ones actually at the keyboard.
Exactly. The victims analyzed the attacks, and every piece of forensic evidence pointed directly to Tehran. So when you know your strategic partner is willing to hijack your sensitive military infrastructure to use you as a scapegoat, you do not hand them the source code to your most advanced malware.
Right, you just can't trust them.
The partnership is one of strategic convenience. It's restricted to low-level hacktivists rather than any trusted sharing of digital assets.
That makes total sense. So because nations like Russia and Iran operate under all this heavy Western pressure, they rely on projecting threats outward, right? Using proxies or hacktivists as a shield.
Yes, precisely.
The ISW notes that while the U.S. has conducted targeted shaping operations, you know, airstrikes on inland Iranian facilities like Semnan Airport and a base near Rasgiran actually deters larger strikes on its energy grid by leveraging its proxies. They threaten to have the Houthi rebels in Yemen completely shut down commercial shipping in the Red Sea and the Bab Mandab Strait.
And we should explicitly connect that geopolitical maneuvering to the daily reality of our listeners, because the Bab al-Mandab Strait is a massive global choke point.
Yeah, it affects everyone.
Right. If Iran uses the Houthis to close it, massive container ships have to reroute thousands of miles around the southern tip of Africa. That adds weeks to transit times. It burns millions of dollars in extra fuel per ship. That is the exact mechanism that causes the price of electronics, clothing, and gas to spike at your local store. Iran uses your wallet as leverage to protect their infrastructure.
So what does this all mean when a heavily sanctioned nation doesn't have a geographic choke point or a proxy militia to use as leverage?
That is the big question.
Right, because if the state can't project power outward, it turns inward and the economic foundation just collapses. Which brings us to the Council on Foreign Relations report on Cuba, sitting just 90 miles off the U.S. coast.
Yeah, Cuba is the stark contrast to Iran here. The humanitarian and economic data coming out of this CFR panel shows a state experiencing systemic failure. I mean, since 2024, they've experienced at least 10 total national blackouts.
And to be clear, we aren't talking about rolling brownouts to save energy. We are talking about the entire nation's power grid completely failing. Why is the grid collapsing so catastrophically?
It's a convergence of things. You have aging Soviet-era power plants that just haven't been properly maintained in decades, and that's compounded by a severe inability to purchase crude oil on the international market simply due to a lack of hard currency. So when the turbines physically break down and there's no fuel to run the ones that actually do work, the whole system collapses.
And the economic contraction is just staggering. The CFR notes their GDP has shrunk by up to 15% since 2020. The official exchange rate is basically a fiction at this point because the informal street rate has hit 660 pesos to a single U.S. dollar.
It's devastating.
Just to put that 660 number into perspective for you listening, at that exchange rate, a basic carton of eggs on the street now costs more than a state worker's entire monthly salary.
That level of hyperinflation creates an unlivable environment, which really drives the most alarming statistic in the CFR report. In just the last 5 years, 2.5 million people have fled the island.
Wow.
That represents 10 to 15% of Cuba's entire population.
But how does a government even survive losing that much of its population, especially since the people leaving are usually working age individuals? At some point, who is left to run the economy?
Well, it accelerates an economic death spiral. The CFR experts frame Cuba's immediate geopolitical future around three potential cliffs.
Okay.
The first cliff is a complete state collapse. This is the scenario where the central government simply loses the physical capacity to govern or maintain order.
Yeah.
You end up with a failed state, an ungovernable landmass roughly four times the size of Haiti, located incredibly close to Florida.
The security and mass migration implications for the entire hemisphere would be unprecedented.
Exactly. Now, the second cliff they mention is sudden regime change. But the experts argue this is actually highly unlikely right now. Even with the economy collapsing, the Cuban leadership maintains intense elite cohesion. The military and internal security apparatus remain highly unified and very effective at suppressing dissent.
And they possess a surprising diplomatic shield too, right? Because despite their economic ruin, Cuba maintains 47 diplomats at the UN in New York.
Yes.
They actively use this presence to build coalitions with other non-aligned nations, which effectively blocks international sanctions regarding their internal repression. And they also generate hard currency to fund this security apparatus by exporting around 2,200 medical workers globally.
Right, a practice the U.S. heavily criticizes as forced labor, but which provides the regime with a vital financial lifeline.
Which leaves the third cliff, a negotiated recalibration with the United States. basically a slow, painful diplomatic settlement driven by the sheer necessity of avoiding total collapse. Oh. But while we analyze these three paths, the brutal reality is that millions of Cuban citizens are trapped in the middle, right? Enduring wartime level deprivations in a country that isn't technically at war.
It perfectly illustrates the limitations of trying to survive modern geopolitical pressure without global leverage.
So we have Russia leaning on cheap drones and fiber optics. We have Iran leveraging hackers and proxy militias. We have Cuba slowly cannibalizing itself to survive. They're all bogged down in this immediate, desperate struggle of asymmetric survival. But while they are fighting in the mud, there is another superpower utilizing its massive industrial base to bypass the need for regional proxies entirely.
Right. We're transitioning from states trying to survive the current system to a state actively building the infrastructure to dictate a completely new global system.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's pull up the final report from the war zone regarding China's naval developments. Because they aren't just building warships, they are building the infrastructure for total self-reliance. Satellite imagery from Planet Labs captured a colossal new ship under construction at the Kamek GSI shipyard on Longsu Island in southeastern China.
Yeah, it is an at-sea resupply ship, which, you know, might not sound as intimidating as a stealth fighter or a nuclear submarine, but strategically, it is far more significant.
The scale of it is hard to wrap your head around. It is 885 feet long and over 120 feet wide. It's a drastically scaled up version of their already massive Type 901 supply ships. It completely dwarfs the U.S. Navy's newest John Lewis class replenishment vessels. But if you are a military planner, why is a giant cargo ship the most important piece of intelligence we've looked at today?
It all comes down to naval doctrine and logistics. A U.S. Navy official recently characterized the last 25 years of American naval operations in the Middle East as fighting in the parking lot of a giant gas station.
Meaning they always had a friendly port nearby, like in Bahrain or Djibouti, where they could dock, refuel, and rearm without much risk.
Exactly. But in a peer-to-peer conflict, those regional ports might be destroyed by long-range missiles, or neutral countries might simply deny access to avoid getting dragged into the war.
Right.
If you want to be a true blue water navy, meaning you can project power across deep oceans globally, you have to bring your gas station and your ammunition depot with you.
Because an aircraft carrier without jet fuel is just a multi-billion dollar floating runway that can't launch a single plane.
Precisely. And this is vital for China because they are currently building massive Type 076 and Type 075 amphibious assault ships.
Yeah.
And we need to define those. They aren't just transport boats. They are essentially floating military bases.
Wow.
A Type 075 can launch heavily armed hovercrafts from its flooded well deck to storm a beach while simultaneously launching attack helicopters from its flight deck.
And that requires an astronomical amount of fuel, ammunition, and spare parts.
Right. If China wants to project that specific kind of massive military power globally, whether to the coast of Africa, South America, or across the Pacific, they cannot rely on a friendly port being available. This 885-foot monster ship allows them to replenish those amphibious assault fleets while constantly moving in the open ocean. It completely unchains their military from regional constraints.
It fundamentally changes how we measure military strength. I mean, the sleek fighter jets get all the glory in the recruitment ads, but the unglamorous 885-foot floating gas station is what actually determines if those jets can show up to the fight.
Exactly.
It's a perfect contrast to the beginning of our deep dive. Sanctioned nations are innovating with fishing nets and fiber optic cables just to survive the skirmishes of today, while China is pouring thousands of tons of steel to dictate the global power dynamics of the next 50 years.
It really is a brilliant synthesis of the intelligence we've covered today. We are witnessing a world where the very nature of warfare and statecraft is simultaneously shrinking and expanding. It shrinks to the size of a $1,000 FPV drone forcing a billion-dollar military to string up physical netting in South Korea. And it expands to the size of a massive naval supply ship designed to project power across entire oceans.
And when you step back and connect these pieces, how a blackout in Havana is fundamentally linked to a drone in the Red Sea, which is linked to a shipyard in Guangzhou, you get a clear roadmap of where international security and your own daily economic reality are heading next.
Yeah, the tactical gray zone we discussed at the start is only going to become more complex.
Which leaves me with a final thought for you to mull over. We've spent this deep dive talking about physical logistics, fuel ships, mesh nets, and fiber optic cables. As these low-tech defensive measures and massive supply chains become the new baseline for survival, it raises a fascinating question.
Right.
Perhaps the next major global arms race won't be fought over advanced AI or hypersonic missiles.
Well, that's an interesting point.
Right. If survival depends on stringing up nylon nets to stop drones and building 885-foot ships to carry fuel, the true decisive battleground of the future might just be a race for raw materials. The nation that controls the nylon, the copper, and the rare earth minerals required to keep these basic physical logistics alive might be the one that ultimately controls the board.
It completely reframes the entire concept of strategic dominance.
It really does. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you. Keep looking for the mechanisms behind the headlines, and we will see you next time.